Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a really fundamental question. What actions does our society deem criminal enough to warrant, you know, making them illegal and punishable?
Yeah, it's foundational stuff. I mean, some things seem obvious, right? Homicide, rape, theft, they just feel inherently wrong.
Exactly. Malum in se, as the old common law term goes, evil in itself.
Right. But then you get into these trickier areas, things like price fixing or what people sometimes call victimless crimes.
That's the malum prohibitum category wrong simply because the law says it is.
Mm-hmm. Though even with those, there's usually some kind of societal goal behind the prohibition, right? Some reason we decided to ban it.
But it gets really interesting when what the community thinks should be a crime doesn't quite match up with the actual laws on the books.
Oh, absolutely. Prohibition is the classic example, isn't it? The law criminalized alcohol, but, well, huge parts of the population just didn't agree. Led to massive problems with enforcement and respect for the law.
So there's this, like, inherent tension sometimes.
Definitely. Especially when you move beyond those core don'ts. The really obvious stuff.
And that's what we're diving into today. Not so much the primary prohibitions like don't kill, but the stuff around those.
Secondary prohibitions, yeah. Things like attempting to kill someone, or helping someone else do it, or even just creating a serious risk of death.
We'll save justifications like self-defense for another time. But today, it's all about these secondary rules, starting with criminal attempt.
Thankfully, just thinking bad thoughts isn't a crime. We'd all be in trouble then.
Huh, true. But somewhere between just thinking and actually doing the crime, you cross a line. It becomes a criminal attempt.
And that leads to what lawyers call inchoate liability. Usually means less punishment than the completed crime, although interestingly, the model penal code suggested they should be punished the same.
Which is pretty controversial.
Yeah. But the first big question is, when exactly does preparation become attempt? There's been tons of debate about that.
So what did the old law say?
The common law developed this test called dangerous proximity. Basically, you had to get really, really close to actually pulling off the crime.
Okay, like how close?
Well, think about that locksmith example from our sources, the one planning to rob the coin shop safe.
Right.
If he just, say, buys tools and looks at the shop under dangerous proximity, probably not enough. But if he's there, drilling the safe, and gets caught,
then he's definitely close.
Exactly. He's dangerously proximate, just moments away from success. That's the threshold.
And the logic there is, you want to stop crime, but maybe not punish someone who might have changed their mind before the last second.
That's part of it. It's about balancing intervention with not penalizing someone who might have desisted.
Yeah.
It focuses on how physically close they got, less on guessing their intent early on.
But that's not the main test used now, is it?
Not usually.
Yeah.
Modern codes, mostly following the model penal code, use the substantial step test.
Okay, substantial step. What does that involve?
It shifts the focus. Instead of asking how close did they get to finishing, it asks how far have they gone after forming the intent.
So it looks earlier in the timeline.
Much earlier, yeah. If you've taken a substantial step towards the crime, and that step strongly shows your criminal purpose, that can be enough for attempt liability.
So going back to the locksmith under this test.
Well, buying specialized safe-cracking tools, casing the joint repeatedly, making a detailed map, things like that could definitely be seen as a substantial step. Even if he hasn't touched the safe, it shows he's serious in moving forward.
It feels like that lowers the bar for liability quite a bit.
It does. It reflects a different view. Perhaps that moral blameworthiness attaches earlier once you've firmly decided and started acting on it. It gives less room for backing out before liability kicks in.
Are there other ways courts look at this?
There are a couple of less common tests.
Got it.
One is probable desistance. Like, would this person likely have stopped on their own if they weren't interrupted?
Speculative.
It can be. And another is unequivocality. Do their actions, viewed objectively, scream criminal intent, no matter what they say they were doing?
So different ways to slice it. Now, what if someone does stop? They get halfway through drilling the safe and just quit voluntarily.
Mm-hmm. Voluntary desistance. Well, the old common law was tough. Once you cross the line into attempts, say, dangerous proximity, that was it. No take backs.
No defense for changing your mind?
Nope. But the model penal code introduced the renunciation defense.
Okay, what's that?
If you completely involuntarily give up the criminal effort, and it has to be a real change of heart, not just chickening out because a police car drove by then, you might have a complete defense to the attempt charge.
Why did the code add that?
It's kind of tied to those other changes we mentioned, because the substantial step test imposes liability much earlier.
Right.
And because the code also suggested punishing attempts the same as completed crimes, well, if you've already taken a substantial step and the punishment is the same anyway, what's your incentive to stop?
Ah, I see. The renunciation defense gives you a reason to back out, even after you've started.
Precisely. It encourages abandonment. And interestingly, even places that don't grade attempts the same as completed crimes often keep the renunciation defense.
Why's that?
Maybe just a sense that someone who truly renounces isn't as blameworthy, you know? Their danger has passed.
This brings us to study one in the source material, right? They looked at what ordinary people think about all this.
Exactly. They used that locksmith scenario again, but tweaked it into 11 different versions.
11? Wow.
Yeah, representing everything from just thinking about it to taking a substantial step, reaching unequivocality, probable desistance, dangerous proximity, actually doing it, and then versions where he renounced or stopped out of fear.
So covering all the legal bases, what did they find?
Well, looking at the liability people assigned, it was pretty low for most of the early stages. Even just thinking about it got a tiny bit of liability from some people, maybe because the scenario made the intent seem really clear.
But the big jump.
The big jump in assigned liability happened when the locksmith reached dangerous proximity. Before that, much lower scores. After that, significantly higher.
So that old common law test seems to match people's gut feelings better.
It really seems to resonate. That point where the person is right on the verge of success feels like the moment people think serious liability should kick in.
What about comparing attempt to the completed crime? Did people agree with the model penal code's equal punishment idea?
Not at all. Respondents consistently gave much lower liability for attempts, even the dangerous proximity ones, compared to the completed robbery.
And the substantial step, where the code might find liability.
People generally assigned very little, if any, liability or punishment just for that initial substantial step. Big disagreement there with the code's approach.
Okay, what about renunciation? Did people think stopping should matter?
Oh, definitely. There was a huge drop in punishment if the locksmith renounced, even after reaching dangerous proximity.
So disagreeing with the old common law no takebacks rule, but aligning with the model penal code defense.
Yeah, right. Which is ironic because the code partly created the defense because of its other rules, the substantial step test and equal grading that the community doesn't seem to support.
Huh. So people support the renunciation defense on its own merits, maybe?
Yeah.
Because it just feels less wrong if someone stops themselves.
Seems likely. It suggests a perceived reduction in blameworthiness.
Did it matter if the locksmith renounced after getting the money?
It still reduced the punishment somewhat, but not nearly as much as renouncing before completing the crime. Maybe seen as less genuine remorse, or maybe because the harm was already done, even if later undone. Remember, the code wouldn't allow the defense after completion.
Did they distinguish between stopping voluntarily and stopping out of fear?
They did. Respondents gave even lower liability for genuine voluntary renunciation compared to stopping because you got scared.
Hmm.
Legally, that distinction often doesn't matter, but people seem to think it did.
So a key theme seems to be whether actual harm occurred.
Absolutely. The liability for a dangerous proximity attempt was pretty similar to a completed robbery where the locksmith tried, but failed, to return the money.
Okay.
But liability was much lower if he renounced before completion, or if he completed it but successfully returned the money, undoing the harm. So both the harm itself and the remorse seem crucial to people's judgments.
And what about that liability but no punishment option?
That popped up a lot for the earlier stages, the ones before dangerous proximity. It suggests people wanted to say, hey, this isn't okay, but maybe didn't think formal punishment was warranted yet. It shows law doing two things, setting rules and assigning blame.
Okay, so summing up study one, people think attempt liability should wait until danger is imminent, attempt should be punished less than completed crimes, and voluntary renunciation should be a powerful mitigator, maybe even a defense.
And remorse or undoing harm after the fact also counts for something.
Legally, this suggests maybe the dangerous proximity test is more in line with community views. Or perhaps, if we want to intervene earlier, we need specific lower-level offenses for preparation.
Could be. And it clearly shows support for some kind of renunciation defense.
All right, let's shift gears to study two. This one looked at creating criminal risk.
Right. You can be held criminally liable just for creating a risk of harm, even if the harm never actually happens. Usually it has to be a substantial risk.
Like reckless driving versus, I don't know, leaving your garden hose out.
Exactly. Codes look at how bad the potential harm is, how likely it is to happen, and why the person was taking the risk.
So what did Study 2 try to figure out?
They wanted to know what the community thinks the minimum level of potential harm and the minimum degree of risk should be for criminal liability and how those two things interact. Importantly, they kept the mental state constant like he's intended to cause harm.
How do they test that?
They used scenarios about a wife poisoning her husband's breakfast. They varied the potential harm, slight injury, moderate, high, and the chance he'd actually eat it, slight risk, medium, high, or actually accomplished.
Did people understand the setup?
Yeah, they did checks called manipulations checks, which confirmed people saw the wife as acting purposefully and understood the differences in risk and potential severity.
Okay, so what happened with liability?
Interestingly, people assigned some liability in basically all the scenarios where she intended harm, even the lowest risk and lowest severity ones.
So no minimum threshold.
Yeah.
If you intend harm and create any risk, that's enough for some liability in people's eyes.
It seems that way when the intent is clearly there. The study was more about grading the severity, which comes later, but the basic finding was liability attached even at low levels.
Did the amount of liability change?
Oh, yeah. As the probability of him eating the poison went up or the potential severity of the injury went up, the assigned liability increased pretty steadily.
Any interactions?
Yes, there was a significant interaction, mostly because the punishment shot way up in the scenario where she succeeded in causing high injury, basically completed murder.
So people's judgments tracked the increasing danger quite smoothly.
Generally, yes. Incremental increases in risk or severity led to incremental increases in liability.
How does that compare to the law?
Well, the model penal code would likely treat all those scenarios where she purposefully tried to poison him as attempted murder. It wouldn't necessarily make the fine distinctions based on probability and severity that the respondents did.
So again, the community seems more focused on the potential harm, even if it's just the level of risk created.
It seems that way. More harm-oriented, perhaps, than the code's strong focus on intent in this context.
Okay, let's move to Study 3. Accomplice liability, helping someone else commit a crime.
Right. This study looked at the objective requirements. What do you actually have to do to be considered an accomplice? The mental state part comes later.
What was the old rule here?
Common law generally required that you actually did encourage or assist the main perpetrator. Just trying to help, but failing, usually wasn't enough.
And the modern penal code.
It broadened things, as it often does. It says even an unsuccessful attempt to aid, or just agreeing to aid, can be enough for accomplice liability.
And if you're an accomplice, you're typically on the hook for the whole crime.
Usually, yes. Full liability, same as the person who physically did it, unlike attempt liability, which is often lower.
So what did Study 3 want to know from the community?
Two main things. What's the minimum contribution people think is needed to be an accomplice? And does the amount of help you give affect how much liability you should face? Most laws treat it as all or nothing, but sentencing guidelines are starting to look at degrees of involvement.
How'd they test this?
Scenarios again. A wife wants her husband dead, and a friend helps or tries to help in different ways. Everything from just thinking about helping to a failed attempt. Simple encouragement, giving minor help, giving her the gun, teaching her how to use it, helping her track him down when he fled, all the way up to masterminding the whole plan. They also varied whether the wife succeeded or failed.
What did they find about the accomplice's role? First off, just thinking about helping.
Zero liability assigned to the friend in that case, even though people agreed the friend approved. This was interesting because in other studies, just having the intent sometimes got a little liability.
Why the difference here?
Maybe because willingness to help feels one step removed from deciding to commit the crime yourself. Or maybe a less settled intention in people's eyes. Hard to say for sure.
Okay, what about when the friend actually did things?
As the friend's involvement increased from failed attempt to encouragement to substantial help, like giving the gun, to necessary help, like teaching her to use it, the accomplice's liability generally went up.
Did it keep going up indefinitely?
It seemed to level off somewhat around substantial help. Even when the friend provided necessary help or even masterminded the plot, their assigned liability was usually lower than the wife's liability, the main perpetrator.
So people see accomplices as less culpable than the primary actor?
Generally, yes. Although the mastermind scenario was interesting, the gap narrowed, and that was the only scenario where the wife got less than a life sentence, suggesting maybe some responsibility shifted to the mastermind friend.
Was there an effect if the wife failed?
Yes. Consistently, when the wife failed to kill the husband, the friend's accomplice liability was reduced compared to when she succeeded.
Again, that harm principle. No completed harm, lower sentence, even for the helper.
Exactly. It aligns with that general tendency. The model penal code might call it complicity in an attempt if the main crime fails, but given the code's equal grading idea, that might not mean a lower sentence in practice.
So, key points from study 3. More help equals more liability, supporting the common law idea that you need actual assistance, not just a failed try. People view accomplice liability on a scale, unlike the law's often binary approach. And accomplices are generally seen as less culpable than perpetrators.
Right. A clear preference for grading liability based on contribution and outcome.
Okay, final study for today. Study 4, looking at liability for omissions failing to act.
Yeah, criminal law is mostly about don'ts, but sometimes it requires do's. The study looked at two things. Do people agree with the law that causing harm by acting is the same as allowing harm by failing a legal duty? And what about the bystander problem, failing to help a stranger when you have no legal duty?
Remind us of the current law on that bystander issue.
In the US and UK systems, generally, there's no legal duty to rescue a stranger, even if it's easy and safe for you to do so. Liability for omission requires a specific, recognized legal duty.
Like parent-child or a lifeguard on duty.
Exactly. Or if you contractually agree to help, or if you start helping and then stop, leaving them worse off, but just walking by someone drowning. Generally, no legal liability if they're a stranger.
Even though that feels morally wrong to many people.
Absolutely. And there's been debate for centuries. Some argue for a duty to rescue when it's low risk. Others worry about line drawing and forcing people into potentially inconvenient actions.
So how did Study 4 explore this?
Scenarios involving someone dying, either by commission, someone pushed them in the water, or omission, someone failed to help. They varied the relationship stranger, parent, lifeguard contract, someone who started to help, and also the danger or inconvenience to the potential rescuer.
What were the main results? Commission versus omission.
Generally, people assigned lower liability for omissions compared to commissions, even when the outcome death was the same. Especially for failing to help a stranger where no legal duty existed.
Why the difference? Did people see the intent differently?
That seemed to be part of it. Respondents were more likely to think the person committing the act wanted the victim to die compared to the person omitting aid. Although, they did agree the bystander was practically certain the person would drown without help.
What about when there was a legal duty parent lifeguard?
Big difference there. In those duty scenarios, a large majority did impose liability and punishment for failing to act. So they agreed with the law that duties matter.
Was the punishment the same as for pushing them in?
No. Even in the duty cases, the assigned liability was significantly lower than for the commission case and lower than what the law would often prescribe, which is typically equivalence.
Okay, now the crucial one. The stranger with no duty. Did people follow the law and assign no liability?
No, they didn't. A majority of respondents imposed criminal liability for failing to rescue a stranger, unless doing so posed a high danger to the rescuer themselves.
So direct disagreement with the current legal doctrine.
A very clear disagreement. And people made nuanced judgments based on the level of risk or inconvenience to the rescuer. Low inconvenience got higher liability than high inconvenience. It wasn't the law's all-or-nothing approach based on duty. It was more of a sliding scale.
Wow. Okay, so pulling all this together, the big takeaway seems to be a pretty significant gap between community intuitions and the formal legal rules on these secondary liability issues.
Yeah, a real disconnect on multiple fronts. When attempt liability should start, how much renunciation should count, whether failed attempts to help should create liability, how attempts compare to completed crimes.
And grading accomplice liability, and especially that duty to rescue strangers.
Right. And interestingly, sometimes the community is stricter than the law, like imposing some liability for just thinking about it or for failing to rescue a stranger.
It really highlights that community views often seem more tied to the actual harm caused or risked compared to the model penal code's strong emphasis on the actor's intent.
That harm orientation comes through again and again.
So, it leaves us with a big question, doesn't it? Given these differences between community views and the legal code, what does that mean for our justice system?
Should the law try to align more closely with these intuitions? Or are there good reasons, perhaps? Consistency, administrability, philosophical principles for the distinctions the law currently makes?
It definitely makes you think about what we expect from criminal law reflecting moral intuitions versus setting clear, perhaps more abstract, rules, food for thought.